Yes, this sedra is called Yisro, but before we start the sedra, I'd just like to mention about current affairs, meaning things that happen in the week, and in Jewish current affairs are Torah current affairs, which means things that happen in the Jewish calendar. So you may or may not know that Sunday night, Monday, was the new year for trees. Were you aware of that? Tesvav Bishvat, the 15th of Shvat. Why is it called the new year for trees? Because in Israel, being a rather warmer country than this one, the trees begin to renew themselves approximately on the 15th of Shvat. It is said that the sap begins to rise up the tree for the new year of fruit bearing, and it has certain halakhic ramifications as well. In fact, we are told in the Mishnah that there are four Rosh Hashanahs. We have the Rosh Hashanah, which is the Rosh Hashanah in Tishri, where the new year begins, which is the day of judgment. But all these Rosh Hashanah are all days of judgment in different ways. So the other Rosh Hashanahs are the new year for trees, and it has halakhic ramifications in that, you know, we take tithes. Right, from the produce of what's grown that year. The question is, what is counted as that year? Week. What is counted as a year? You know, you have the tax year.
Yeah.
So the tax year runs April to April, April the 5th, whatever it is. So what you earn from April the 5th to April the 4th or the 6th to the 5th, whatever it is, that's your earnings for the year. If you earned something on April the 10th, it belongs to the next tax year. Well, you have the same idea in Jewish law as well. So you have the law of Maisros, which is tithes. So when a fruit grew in one year up to the 15th of Shvat, it belongs to that year. But if the fruit matured after the 15th of Shvat, then it belongs to the next year. Then, of course, there's a whole discussion as what is called maturity, at what stage of the growing of the fruit. Are we talking about the blossoming, or after the blossom, or full maturity? You know, there's all debates about that as well. But it doesn't change the principle that you have years defined for the tithes. The other two new years are the new year for kings. When a king is appointed and anointed, it's called the first year of his reign. So when does his reign go into the second year? Do we count it from... Then it stops raining, very good. That's when he dies, it stops raining.
Very rich too.
So the question is, do we talk about the relative date of when they became king? So if they were appointed king on the, you know, the 10th of... Cheshvan, so the next 10th of Cheshvan is going to their second year. You could do that. Or you could say, we have a standardized year for kings, and then even if they were appointed and anointed the day before the end of that year, it's counted as the second year of their rule only 2 days later. And that is the latter view that the Torah adopts. And the first of Nisan is the new year for kings. Yeah. So even if he was appointed only 1 month before, he's in his second year. The reason is because they used to mint coins, and they used to put the date. They didn't have the year date, wasn't always the case. They had different ways of defining years. One of the ways of defining years in olden days was defining it as the year of King so-and-so. So if you would say in the second year, like in the Megillah's Esther, in the third year of the rule of King Ahasuerus, etc.
So the first of Nisan, did you say?
The first of Nisan, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, and then the final one is the first of Elul, which is the new year for tithing animals. Since animals are born sort of in the spring and summer...
Rosh Chodesh Elul, yeah. And the puppies.
Pardon? No, kittens and puppies are born any time, but sheep, for example, the lambs gambling, yeah? You know we're not supposed to gamble, but lambs do. So the lambs gamble in the spring, and other animals are born around about that time. They do have a season, and therefore the tithing season it starts again on Rosh Chodesh Elul, which is like the end of the summer. So we have basically four New Years. I'd just like to share with you a thought which the Rebbe shared with us, two thoughts in fact, about the New Year for trees. One of the lessons of trees is that trees, we are expected to grow. Now we know that physically we don't grow more than beyond 18, maybe, exceptionally beyond 18, but normally that's about the age where we reach our full adult size. But so therefore you might think, well, I've finished growing, so I am what I am, and that's it. But Judaism teaches that although we've stopped growing physically, well, I suppose more accurately we could say people grow in height up to 18, mm-hmm. and in girth from 18.
Yeah.
So we do continue growing in certain senses.
Knowledge and wisdom.
Yeah. Right. So the point is, we might stop growing physically, but we need to grow spiritually and intellectually. And that never stops. Some people think, yeah, you know, I've had my education.
I'm clever.
And now I'm qualified. I've, you know, got there. Now I just have to do my job and I earn the money and I'm fine. Judaism says, every single day is a day for more learning, bettering ourselves, improving ourselves, looking at ourselves analytically and seeing where is the room for improvement. That's an ongoing process, just like a tree. A tree is an amazing creature. It's the only thing of its kind that does this. No other creature does this. Plants, they live and die. The trees go on, not forever, but they go on. Animals, they don't grow forever. They're like human beings, they don't grow forever. But a tree keeps on growing. And that's how we know the age of the tree, by the fact the number of circles, the number of rings in the when the tree's cut down, the trunk can be counted, the rings, and you know how old the tree is. That means that every single year the tree adds another ring of growth. And it probably grows up a bit higher as well. It may not be so noticeable, but it does. And an old tree, like the giant redwoods, which are thousands of years old, you know, they would be forgiven for saying, well, I'm 1,000 years old, genugshoin, I've had enough already, I can stay the way I am. No, the next year the tree's even bigger. So that is a very profound and important lesson for us, how we have to realize that we have to grow. The second thing is, the Rebbe pointed out, that what are we celebrating? We're celebrating the fruits of the tree. Now, we know that Israel was blessed with seven kinds. First, two grains. It's mentioned in the Torah, in the Book of Devarim, in the Sedra, Akev, or Rehe, one of the two, I can't remember now. But it says over there, Eretz Chita Osaira, a land of wheat and barley. Eretz Chita Osaira, Gethen V'Rimon Useina, that is a land of vines, pomegranates, and figs. Eretz Zeh Shemen Udvash, a land of olive oil and honey. And the honey referred to there is honey of dates, not the honey of bees. So we have five fruits and two staples. The two staples are wheat and barley.
Do they mention the dates separately or not?
It does not mention the word dates. Okay. It just says dvash, meaning honey, but the rabbis say it means honey of dates, because it's mentioning fruits over there. So there are five fruits. The grape, the pomegranate, the fig, the olive, and the date. And those are the fruits that we're celebrating on the 15th of Shvat. So the Rebbe said, what's the difference between the two staples, wheat and barley, and fruits? The answer is, wheat and barley are stapled, that's why they're called that. Because you can't live without some carbohydrate. You need wheat, you need barley, whatever, or another carbohydrate, but those staples are necessary. So that's like, you know, the bread and butter of life.
Yeah.
But fruits are more for the sake of pleasure. we need fruits. I know they talk about five a day. Mm. We need, but you could actually equally well get your vitamins from vegetables, which aren't half as tasty as fruits. Mm. Mm. So fruits are a kind of extra, the icing on the cake. It's a tainug. It's a pleasure to have fruit. It's, you know, when you have bread, you know, you have a staple like some breakfast cereal. You don't have breakfast cereal for pleasure. You have that to have breakfast. But if you want an apple, it's as much for pleasure as it is, you know, to fill the gap between breakfast and lunch. So this, the Rebbe pointed out, is a lesson in our attitude to Yiddishkeit. Our attitude to Judaism could be on the basis, well, you know, I'll do the basics. You know, I'll do what I have to do. Just get on with it. You know, God says do this, God says do that, daily prayers, keeping Shabbos, keeping Yom Tov, learning something, putting on tefillin for men, lighting candles for women. These are the basics. I'll do those. But, you know, to kind of like live my Judaism in an exciting way, in a sort of pleasurable way, where I'm doing even more than the basics, people, very often people are turned off that kind of thing. You know, they want to have their own hobbies. And Judaism, you know, I do what I have to do, and that's it. So the Rebbe said, but the lesson from fruit is that Judaism demands of us that we should invest some pleasurable activity in our Judaism as well. Not just be satisfied with the staple. Just like in a staple diet, we're not satisfied with just bread and butter. We want something extra as well. So also in our Judaism, we need some extra dimension to it as well, and that means putting some enthusiasm into it, some excitement into it, some joy into it, pleasure, and that takes a bit of effort, because it can become very humdrum if you let it. And there are lots of Jews all over the place that just live, you know, the minimum level of Judaism that can be, but that's not the intention. The idea is to grow and to have pleasure sort of more depth to one's Yiddishkeit. So that is the New Year for Trees. There's lots more to be learned from it, but that should suffice for the moment, because we've got what to speak about in the Sedra as well. So this is a Sedra Yisro. It's page 131. You got it? What is special about this Sedra is that it is the Sedra in which we read of the Ten Commandments. And Jethro was the father-in-law of Moses. And he was a convert. He was a Midianite, actually. But he saw in Moses greatness. His father. Moses married his daughter Zipporah when he fled from Egypt as a young man. And later, although Jethro was a Midianite, a non-Jew, and an idol worshipper, and not just an ordinary idol worshipper, but he was actually the high priest of Midian. And that meant that he was an expert on idol worship. And the rabbis tell us there was not a single idol that he had not served. He was an expert on all of them. And yet, this man decided to give all that up and become a Jew. And he gave rise to generations of converts. Well, they weren't converts. Once the fathers become a convert, the children become ordinary Jews, and he took his place amongst the great ones of the Jewish people. The rabbis tell us that his career as a lover of Jews actually started years before, because he was one of three advisors to Pharaoh. And the rabbis tell us these three advisors epitomized the three things that one can be: positive, negative, or neutral. Who was positive? Jethro. Who was negative? Bilam, the infamous Bilam that we meet in the summer when we read the Sedra Bala, the one that tried to curse the Jewish people. And the one in the middle, the floating voter, the neutral one, was Eov, Job. And the rabbis tell us of a number of occasions where they were asked advice by Pharaoh, and Jethro said something positive about the Jews, or Moses in fact, and Eov said something non-committal, and Bilam said, no, negative, One example is when it came to Moses himself. The story is told that when he was a little baby, don't forget, he was picked up on the Nile by Pharaoh's daughter. So she brought him to the palace, and he was a little baby, and he was sitting on Pharaoh's knee, and Pharaoh's wearing his crown, which is full of bright jewelry, and Moses, the little baby, puts out his hand and grabs the crown. And Pharaoh was horrified. And his advisors immediately said, "This means he's going to take your crown, he's going to be a usurper. Kill him now." So Pharaoh turned to his advisors, and he said, "What shall we do?" These three advisors. So Jethro said, "He's only a baby, leave him, it's all right." And Bilam said, "Kill him." And Eov said, "No, I'm not sure. I can't really say for sure." And he wouldn't commit himself. In the end, they decided to do a test. And the advisor said, I'm not sure who it was that said it, he said he's attracted by the shining jewelry, so bring something else shining and he'll take that. And they brought some burning coals which are shining, and he put out his hand. He says an angel came and made him put out his hand to take it, and he took it and put it to his lips, and that's why he became a stammerer. Why was that done to him? To save his life. Because if he had not picked up the burning coals, that would have shown that he really did want the crown, and they would have killed him on the spot. But anyway, that tells us that Jethro was a defender of the Jewish people even from those early times, and his reward came in the fact that he saw and heard about the great miracles that had happened to the Jewish people, and as a result of that he decided to come and join in the giving of the Torah that was destined for the Jewish people. And the Seder begins with that episode of him arriving with Moses' wife and two children from Midian to join the Jewish people and receive the Torah. So let's read. Vayishma Yisro Kohen Midian Chosem Moshe Eis Kol HaShehoseh Lekim LeMoshe UliYisrael Amon. Jethro, the high priest of Midian, the father-in-law of Moses, heard everything which God had done to Moses and to his people Israel. Kihotzi Hashem as he saw Mimitzrayim, when God had brought out the Jewish people from Israel, from Egypt. So he'd heard the news. He heard great events. Rashi says he heard about the splitting of the Red Sea. He heard about the war with Amalek and how they miraculously won. And of course he'd heard already about the great signs and wonders and miracles that happened in Egypt as well. So he was suitably impressed, and of course he knew the greatness of Moshe as well, and so he came along. He wanted to see for himself. And Yisro, the father-in-law of Moses, took Tzipora, the wife of Moses, after he had sent her. Now this is interesting, because the question is, why was Tzipora not with the Jewish people when they came out of Egypt? Remember, Moses had returned to Egypt with his wife and his two sons. We learned about that a few weeks ago in the Seder Shmos, when God appeared to him in the desert at the burning bush, and he told him to go to Egypt. He went back to Jethro, he asked permission to leave, and he says he took his wife and two children with him, and he made them ride on an ass, and he approached Egypt. So what are they doing back home? How did they get there? So Rashi picks this up and tells us of an interesting episode. He tells us that when Moses originally came to Egypt with his wife and two sons, he was met by his brother Aaron, who was told by God to go out and meet Moses on the way. So Aaron comes to meet him, and he didn't know that Moses was married, because they'd been separated for many, many years. Moses was 80 at the time. So he says, Aaron says to him, "Who are these? Who are these people?" So he says, "This is my wife and two sons." He says, "Where are you going?" He says, "I'm bringing them to Egypt." He said, "Well, don't we have enough problems with the Jews already in Egypt? So you're bringing more? You know, we're all slaves in Egypt, and you're bringing more people to be in Egypt." So Moses said, "What should I do?" So he said, "Send them home." So they turned round and went back home, and Moses continued on his own. So they went back home to their father and grandfather, Jethro, and they stayed there, which is an interesting thing. because it means that Moses' wife and two sons did not experience anything to do with the going out of Egypt. Not the plagues, not the smiting of the firstborn, not the Yetzias Mitzrayim, not the splitting of the Red Sea. They didn't see any of it.
But did they come after that?
Right, so this is an interesting question that you've just asked. When did they come, is your question. Mm. So there are, in fact, two opinions. One opinion says that Jethro came before the Torah was given and participated in the giving of the Torah. And the other opinion says that he came after the Torah was given. Which makes an interesting situation, which would be that Zipporah, the wife of Moshe, and her two sons were not there when the Torah was given. Which itself is quite amazing. Especially, and I've had this difficulty for many years, especially as the Rebbe pointed out on more than one occasion that the Torah could not have been given unless every Jew was there. Mm. And if Zipporah and Moses' two sons were not there, this has implications. So, very often we have questions which we don't have answers to straight away, and we wait a few years and later on you find the answer. Let's get back to the point. So here comes Jethro. Let's assume that, according to the opinion, that he came before the Torah was given. And he is absolutely overwhelmed by what he's heard, and he wants to share. So, v'eishnei v'ne'a sh'ashem l'echa gershom, ki oma ger ha'yisi be'es nachriya. And these, together with the two sons, one of them was called Gershom, whom we've met already in the Sedra Shemos, for he said, I was a stranger in a strange land. V'shem o'echad Eliezer, and one of them he called Eliezer, ki elokei avi be'ezri v'yatzilein mecherev para. And he called him that because the God of my father is to my help, and he saved me from the sword of Pharaoh. So what does it mean he was saved from the sword of Pharaoh? Well, certainly it happened once when he was a little baby, that story which I just told you. But another event happened in the Sedra Shemos as well, whereby he had an episode with the two brothers, Dothan and Aviron, who were fighting, and he said to them, why are you fighting? And he tried to stop them fighting, and they said, are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? Because the previous day he'd killed an Egyptian that was beating a Jew. Mm. A Jew was being beaten to death by an Egyptian, so he wanted to save his life. Mm. So he killed this Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And these two Jews saw him, and they threatened to tittle-tattle. Mm. In fact, they did so. Because they said to him, when he interfered with their argument, are you going to kill one of us like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? So he realized that his life is in danger. And according to one opinion, he ran away. According to other opinions, he was arrested and taken to be executed. And the rabbis tell us an amazing miracle happened, and his neck turned into, he was going to be beheaded, his neck turned into marble, and he was saved. He ran away and was saved. So that's Vayatzileni Mecherev Paro, that he was saved from the sword of Pharaoh, literally. Mm-hmm. For the sword never penetrated his neck. So it's interesting also that this is the first time we learn of the name of his second son. Although we read of the bris of his second son, in the Sedra Shemos, on his way back to Egypt, it says that in the inn where they stayed, an angel tried to kill him, and the rabbis tell us because he had failed to give a bris to his son, that son was Eliezer, his second son, and he doesn't mention his name over there. And yet over here he does mention his name and the reason why he was called that. Interestingly, it also mentions Gershom again, and also the reason for him being given the name again, although it mentioned it already in the Sedra Shemos. So these are interesting diukim, what's called, pointing out variances in the text which need explanation. Of course, there must be an explanation. The Torah doesn't repeat itself for no reason. And it's interesting that the name of Eliezer is suppressed prior to this, and suddenly we learn it now. All of this is explained, but we won't go into it now. Let's deal a little bit with the Sedra itself, which we've just begun reading, But the significant part of the Sedra, or most significant part, which is the giving of the Ten Commandments. Now, people misunderstand about the Ten Commandments. Let's turn forward to where the Ten Commandments are announced. And that is page 133, or in fact goes into 134. The first commandment is on page 134. There's a misunderstanding about these Ten Commandments. Some people think that they are exceptionally relevant laws. People talk about transgressing the Ten Commandments. Is there any qualitative difference between transgressing or keeping one of the Ten Commandments and any other mitzvah of the Torah? I mean, it says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Is there something more significant about Shabbos than, say, Yom Kippur or Pesach? I mean, we know Shabbos, it has got certain strictnesses about it.
That's something that happens every week, isn't it, Shabbos?
That is true, but there are other mitzvahs that happen every day.
No, just my opinion. That's something, whereas the holidays, okay, certain times of the year, but Shabbos is every week. It's happening.
That is true. That is true. But that doesn't change the significance of the law. Well, one of them is here, honor your parents. It's very fundamental to honor parents. Right? But surely there are other parts of the Torah which is just as fundamental, are there not? Don't steal. He's over here. But don't bear false witness. I mean, they are powerful laws, these. The question is, if someone transgresses one of these, have they transgressed more than another law of the Torah? And the answer is no. No. Here over here it says, do not steal. There's another law which says, don't tell lies. Don't say something false in court. Although it says it over here. But there's a midrash shekatircha. Keep away from telling lies. If a person steals and a person tells lies, they're equally culpable in Jewish law. In fact, telling lies can cause more damage than stealing something.
Definitely.
Telling tales about somebody that may or may not be true. Lashon hara. You know, lashon hara means evil tongue. Telling tales about people that may be true or not true. Lashon means tongue, and ra means bad. So there are certain other laws in the Torah which, in terms of the effect, could be even more significant than these laws. I mean, one of them is quite, you might say, an innocuous law. It says, lo sachmod, do not covet. Do not covet means, don't be jealous of someone else's property. You're walking down the road, you see a nice house. And in your heart, you want that house. And the rabbis actually specify how just the thought alone is not enough to transgress. It's got to be that you take some action on it as well. And you try and get that property from the other person by fair means or foul. But still, if the Torah is talking about a thought over here, do not covet your neighbor's house, his wife. I don't know why one would covet someone else's wife, but well, yeah.
Especially when you've got one of your own.
That's right. So, the Torah is really, in a sense, warning us against having a wrong thought. Now, can you compare that to telling a lie, which is actually saying it to somebody else and causing no end of problems for the other person, as some people here have experienced many times over? So, this is the answer, that these laws are actually not different in quality to any of the other 613 laws of the Torah. They are, however, general laws. In fact, Reb Sadia Gaon explains that all the 613 laws are hinted by the 10 over here. That within these 10, they're like categories, and all the other laws will fit into those categories. And he showed how they all are somehow or other attached to each of these 10 laws. Yeah. And another interesting thing is that there are 620 letters in the Ten Commandments, which correspond to the 613 mitzvahs plus the 7 rabbinic laws. So that is also a very interesting thing. It shows you how the Ten Commandments are kind of what's called klolim. There's kind of generalities which encompass everything else. But nevertheless, getting back to the point. So what was the significance of the giving of the Torah? That is the question. If the laws here are no different to the laws in any other part of the Torah, what's the big noise all about? Mm. What's the thunder and lightning all about?
Well, that was the Torah, wasn't it?
Were they clarified?
Well, they're clarified, but I'm asking, if these laws here, the Ten Commandments, are no different to any other law.
Ten, in other words.
Well, two of them are absolutely fundamental, and without which Judaism doesn't exist. Mm. And the first one is, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt, and do not have any other gods besides me. And the rabbis explained that these two laws also are mitzvahs kolim, which include all the other laws. That I am the Lord your God includes all the 248 positive laws, and do not have any other gods besides me includes all the other all the 365 negative laws. But the point is, why all the thunder and lightning?
Only the Ten Commandments were given.
Before the Ten Commandments, weren't they all kind of heathens, though, Mr. Fodrish?
Weren't they all heathens?
I mean, there was no law as such to all the Ten Commandments. They didn't believe in anything.
Well, that is the second part of the question.
Once they got the Ten Commandments, they sort of, let's say, began to be a bit more civilized. Once they got the, they were like heathens, weren't they? They didn't know anything. Is that right, or not right?
You're partially right.
Yeah, you know, they were like... They
you're partially right. Even it, in that, the Jewish people had sunk into idol worship
they had no,
when they were in Egypt.
To follow.
However, you're not entirely right. Yeah. Because there were certain sections of the Jewish people that did learn Torah and did maintain loyalty to God's teachings. And in addition... They weren't totally heathen in the sense that they didn't know any of God's teachings before, because the rabbis tell us that our ancestors kept the Torah as well even before it was given. In other words, the Torah morality and the Torah teachings were known beforehand. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob
plus they
knew.
Had the seven laws of Noah, which meant
plus they had
that
the seven
wasn't
years.
About God.
But well, no, belief in God. Belief in God is one of them. Yeah. And not to worship either.
No, I thought the Ten Commandments, once they had, they actually put it more in perspective. Like once they had.
Well, that's what I say. You're partly right and partly wrong, because they had become heathen, some of them, but some of them had remained loyal. Now, I can bring you a very simple proof that the teachings of the Torah existed before the Torah was given. For example, Noah, right, who lived a long time before the Torah was given, was told to take into the ark how many animals? Two? Of which animals?
The non-kosher ones.
Mm. But he was told to take seven of the kosher ones. And it actually uses the word Tomei and Tahar. Or it uses the word Tahar, which means pure, clean, kosher. So it says, the behemoth Hatar is the the pure, clean, kosher animals, take seven. The other ones, two. Now that means that Noah had to know a principle of the Torah of knowing which is a kosher animal. That means he had to know the law of cloven hooves and chewing the cud. Now where on earth could he know that from? The answer is that God appeared to Adam and gave him some laws. And he appeared to Noah and gave him an extra law. To Adam he gave six laws. To Noah he gave an extra law, making seven laws. In addition, God communicated to the early generations certain principles of the Torah. And that was one of them. And for example, Noah brought a sacrifice. How did he know how to bring a sacrifice? How did he know how to shecht? Yeah, bring your sacrifice. You can't shoot it. You've got to shecht it. It's very specific with a sharp knife and everything. So that means they knew the basics of the Torah even before, which compounds the question of what is so special about the giving of the Torah. What did it denote? If they knew the actual teachings before, And it's no different to the teachings that were given afterwards either. What was it? So the Rebbe explains this, actually something which he has said over many, many times. And he said the giving of the Torah was a watershed in the relationship between the world, the physical world, and the world of the spirit. The spiritual world and the physical world. Up till that time, the world of the spirit was totally divorced from the physical world. Spirituality was up there,
right.
Physicality was down here, and there the twain shall meet.
It says earlier, and I've sealed a covenant with your people, with your entire people, your nation. They've made distinctions such as have never been made in all the world with any other nation. So they made some clarifications.
Right. In the Sedra, yeah.
Well, but at, right at the beginning,
there's
a piece where it said something like that. The distinctions.
That is true. That is true. Yeah. So you've added an excellent point, which is that the giving of the Torah made the Jewish people distinctive compared to the other nations. It distinguished them from the, and that's tackle. We make the blessing of Havdalah when we say that God made a distinction between Yisrael lo'amim, between the Jewish people and the other nations. And Atah bechartanu mikol ha'amim, you chose us from amongst the nations. That is absolutely true, and the giving of the Torah did actually achieve that. So that is definitely a point we can make about why there should be such a big terrorem about it, because that gave a certain status to the Jewish people, where God said, we are a treasure to him. You shall be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And Va'atam Tioli Am Segula, which means a treasure, a treasure. So that is true, and thank you for pointing that out. But it still begs the question of what was new about the revelation of these teachings at that particular point in time. So that's definitely a point. But as I said, the Rebbe explains that what this achieved was, and it's based on a Medrash which says that God said, it's as if the Elyonim, the upper beings, cannot come down below. And the lower beings, that's humanity and this world, cannot go up above. And it gives an example of two countries far from each other, right? Roimi is Rome, and I can't remember the name of the other country. So it says that the people of Rome can't go to country B, and the people of country B can't go to Rome. There's a barrier. But then the king lifts the barrier, and the people from each country can go, can visit each other. So this was the giving of the Torah, that the world of spirituality can impregnate the physical world and can actually change it. Whereas before, spiritual things could be done, mitzvahs could be done, but it didn't change anything. The actual physical world was not transformed in any way. But God gave the ability for us to transform the physical world into something spiritual. And that was the uniqueness of the giving of the Torah. Laws we knew before, laws we knew after. Mitzvahs there were before, mitzvahs there were after. Torah there was before, Torah there was after. But this idea that the physical world can be transformed into a spiritual entity, that didn't exist. And that is a basic step forward in the coming of Mashiach. Because Mashiach is the one to reveal that everything in creation, including the physical, is impregnated with godliness. And we'll, when Mashiach comes, we'll see the godliness in the physical. But the preparation for that is doing mitzvahs with physical objects and drawing down the godliness into it, albeit in a concealed way, into the physical object. So that is the crux of this week's
Thank you.